Love Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to the Kay Thompson Live Show. I am with a person that's known as the Sun, Citizen Payne, and this is the Kay Thompson Live Show. And you are, here you go.
I am Kay Thompson, and welcome to Kay Thompson Live. We're going to be talking to a well-known radio host from WWRL and New York, and he's heard all over the country, I would imagine, and his name is Bob Law. And most of the people in New York and surrounding areas have listened to Bob over the years, and we're going to be talking to him tonight about, guess what? Guess who? Yeah, I can hardly say the name. But Bob Law will be calling in soon. And we are also waiting for Wayne Gilman to check in and Byron Saunders. Boy, the weeks are going by with Omarosa in the news, loud and wrong. Now, we're also going to be finding out all about that. So, therefore, we may just even open up the phones for a couple of minutes, maybe during the bottom of the show. Or doing the inside of the show, so you maybe want to take, you know, a number down. So, Eric?
Yeah. Omarosa. Here's our other co-host, Byron Saunders. Welcome into the show. Here we go. Byron Saunders, how you doing, brother?
Well, I'm blessed and highly favored. I'm in D.C. after my trip down to Montgomery to see the Equal Justice Initiative Museum and Lynching Memorial. It's so impactful and moving. I recommend everybody go see this museum. It's a lot, and I went back through Tuskegee on my trip. And Atlanta to see family and friends, but I'm in D.C. For a couple more days before I return back to New York City, but I'm blessed. Good to be alive. Washington, D.C. is jumping, you know, this Omarosa thing. Oh, my goodness.
She's really something. She has upset the entire country, but mainly the person in the White House.
Absolutely, but he called her a dog. You know, this whole thing of his racist attitude and his vilifying all black people. I mean, and I have to tell you, because being here on in D.C. with Sunday, the anniversary of Charlottesville on Saturday, and then the march of the so-called alt-right, what a bunch of punks they are. They 24 people, that's all they got. And that shows
what?
You who the Trump base really is. 24
mm-hmm.
people of the white races show up to get all that attention in Washington, D.C. And I'm telling you, it's time we stop believing that the 25 to 35% of his base are that powerful. They're not. We need to start flipping them completely and ushering them straight out of Washington, D.C., from the White House, drain that swamp. Because we don't need to bring an exorcist in once we get through getting rid of all of that bad odor in there. That's foul. It's very foul.
Wow. Boy, oh boy. I don't even know what to say about that, because in Washington, you would think that the people would really be more upset than they really are. It seems like almost like a foreign country. I don't even
they
know what's going to be happening. Yeah.
See, the point is, and this is where our black media really comes in hand for why, like last week's conversation that we were having, the importance of our black media, the voices that we need to hear, because the people of Washington, D.C., and for most of the nation, really don't comprehend the fact that Washington, D.C. is still a predominantly black city. And the people here in Washington, D.C. were highly aggravated. But you don't read that in the newspapers. You don't see that on Meet the Press. You don't see that on Face the Nation. You got to hear it right here on Kay Thompson Live. And I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C. right now. And I can tell you, this city was livid with the way the federal government was letting these clowns come walking down Pennsylvania Avenue. How dare they? You see, that would not happen if this city were had home rule.
Go ahead, Byron. Yeah, no, they probably wouldn't have done that. I knew in D.C. was going to be a problem for them. And then the dude was talking about he's not really a neo-Nazi or whatever, backtracking that he did. But, you know, that's how, what happens when, you know, and the rubber got to meet the road, huh? Sometimes the rubber gives. And, of course, that's going to take place out there where they had to get on the metro to ride into D.C. Once they get off the metro, they had to get an escort to work, whatever, going, because all that stuff don't fly in certain circles. But, you know,
that's right on
for them, you know.
Well, I think one of the things we can look forward to is that Manafort trial, the jury was sent out with its instructions this afternoon, and I just hope they can come back with it, because, you know, the defense didn't put up any witnesses whatsoever. They're hoping that Gates is perceived to be a liar, and that his testimony against Manafort would be, you know, would be enough for a jury not to find, you know, to acquit him. But this is an open and shut case, and I certainly hope they come back with all charges against him, you know, to take him down completely, because it'll send a clear message to the White House and all those phony lawyers from Giuliani on down that they're not playing in this investigation. They need to send a strong message right now, because the Justice Department and the justice system itself has to stand up to make all our democratic ideals become real again. Because right now we're getting played, totally.
Repeat that again. You're saying the Justice Department should do what? I'm sorry.
They should, the Justice, I hope the Manafort trial, that the jury comes back quickly with a decision to find him guilty on all counts, because our justice system is under attack, and the only way it's going to redeem itself is to have the system completely work as it should, and these guys and lawyers and money, the 1% who think they can buy their way through the court systems, need to be put back into their box. They can't. Justice is about those 12 six men, six women who are going to deliberate in the Manafort, because this is the biggest of all the indictments at the moment from the Mueller investigation, and it has to set a precedent right now. Otherwise, we can kiss this empire goodbye, because justice and voting are the only two elements left in our system to help redeem and right the ship that's been on rocky ground right now. America's system of democracy is being laughed at from around the world.
Yeah, that's true. But also, too, you know, we kind of put the fix in. You know, as you know, the American justice system, in my opinion, is not as thorough as everybody likes to make it.
True.
Not as thorough as everybody likes to make it seem, right? So, you know, I mean, with the particularly if we talk about the actions of the judge, right? How he was trying to admonish the prosecution and put his finger on the scale to a certain degree. And everything is about, you know, we could have rules and all this stuff in America is this and it's that. However, it's all about who's running. Who's running the mechanisms, right? Who are the cogs in the wheel? Who are the people that are the infrastructure people? That's really what it boils down to, right? I just saw an article today about one of the guys on Trump's staff who was a former head of Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, which is the maker of insulin, which has gone up a couple hundred dollars since 1996. And I just saw a story on the national NBC News tonight about diabetics having to ration their insulin medicine because it's so expensive. And people talk about how great Trump is and for the economy and what he's doing and all this stuff. And here and yet, he's got a guy who used to be head of the corporation that makes insulin that raised the price on it. So, you know, it's all about who's calling the shots. I mean, they set up a system and a myth about a system and talk about this is what we should do and tell everybody, live as I say you should live, do as I say, not as I do. That's what they want. That's the difference between everybody else and the 1%. But I'm going to go ahead and welcome our guest for this evening, legendary newsman, I believe. Maybe this is his number, Mr. Bob Law. Is that you, Mr. Law?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the K Thompson Live Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Now, knowing that's right, Byron. Give him props there.
I just want to say, Bob Law, I met, and I'm going to remind him because he's got a great memory for history. Bob Law, you are legendary. Now, I'm going to take you way back to 1987. I came into your studios as a guest from the Cool Achiever Awards, Brown and Williamson. And I sat there in your studio for an interview back in 1987. Now, that may shake your cobwebs a little bit, but you have been someone who I've admired for many, many years. And so to have you on K Thompson Live, this is really very spiritual and very much magical. So, once again,
Mr. Law, Byron. That is one of our co-hosts, Byron Saunders. Excellent co-host and historian that is working with
us. Thank you so much. Thank you for. I remember when you came in the studio, you had on a green sweater and a blue shirt.
See, I knew you. See, your mind is sharp. Let me tell you, folks. Bob Law is the historian. Okay.
And I'm glad to say hello to you tonight, though.
Yes, sir, my friend.
Bob Law, how does it feel to be known and remembered as a great historian?
Wait,
and
say
still
it again.
Thought of as a great historian, and you're really very tall.
Yes. Exactly.
That's true. That's true also.
So, Mr. Law, so the question is, you know, the elephant, the 800-pound gorilla, your boy, the president, Mr. Trumpet, my mother was saying that you wrote an article that you were talking about him, and I know that you have your opinions and your thoughts about this. Why don't you share with us and with everybody else that's listening, what do you think of, you know, our homie that's president now?
Well,
what do you think?
Let me just say this. I just did a show. I'm on the air on Tuesday afternoons now, doing a weekly show, and I interviewed our brother Hakeem Adebuti from Third World Press in Chicago, and he has just co-edited a book, which is a collection of essays about Trump, and that I think I might have sent his essay to your mom. And the title of the book is Not My President. And there are a number of people who won't call him president. They call him 45, you know, but they don't refer to him as president. And I kind of, I'm with that, you know, it's not my president. But, and also doesn't really deserve the title president since Obama had distinguished the Oval Office with integrity. Mike, there are things that he didn't do politically that trouble some of us, but he did distinguish the Oval Office with integrity. And this guy really doesn't even deserve to follow Obama into that position. But he did. And that's what I really would like to talk about. See, during the campaign, Michelle Obama was the cheerleader for when they go low, we go high. And so that was a central theme. If they go low, we go high. The lower they go, the higher we go. Well, we went high, they went low, and they won. And so it seems to me that it might be time for us to look past Trump. He is what he is. Can't be denied. People around I was listening to the BBC broadcast, a newscast on the BBC the other day. People around the world, people in other countries are dismayed, have acknowledged that Trump is a despot. And he is. all of what he does, the thing he did today in revoking security clearance, and it's been pointed out that he is only revoking security clearance and only coming out against people who disagree with him, people who criticize him. It's not like he's saying everybody who is no longer in government can have security clearance, only those people who criticize Trump. And that's a totalitarian posture that he is taking. And that is my concern. He is moving more and more toward a totalitarian state. And I think we have to ask now, the Trump supporters, what's up with y'all? Let's look at the Trump supporters. How is it possible that you continue to make excuses, continue to talk about Trump? On my show yesterday, in the first part of it, I said I want to hear from people, Trump supporters or not. I'm not going to challenge you. I just want to hear your thoughts, whoever you are, for the first 30 minutes. This is going to give you a platform. And the two people who called in to support Trump, they just lie. One guy said that, you know, I'm a liberal, I'm open-minded. It's like the people who Trump supporters who say, I voted for Obama twice, I just want to change. See, they're lying. They never voted for Obama.
That's right.
You know, if they voted for Obama, and the news reporters don't challenge that. If you voted for Obama twice, the logical question would be, well, what was it about Obama the second time that made you vote for him? See if they can answer that, because they really never voted for Obama. One guy who calls me says that Trump, he's open-minded, but when he hears the criticism of Trump, he just doesn't find anything credible, doesn't find anything of value, so he's continuing to go with Trump. When Trump says derogatory things about particular ethnic groups, this guy says, well, as it turns out, I mean, he's just telling the truth. I mean, he's right. So, and then you got to say, what's wrong with this guy? You know what is? I used to do that on Night Talk. Every now and then I would say, this is not a facetious question. White folk, what's wrong with y'all? Why do you have to have white supremacy? Why do you have to have mythology? Why do you have to have superheroes? Why do you have to have this fake fighter Rocky and the all of the superheroes and, you know, the guy with the archaeologist who made a series of movies about the
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones. And why do you have to have all of those kind of mythical superheroes and Tarzan? You know,
you messing with America. You better slow down, brother. You messing with America and what they believe. Let me just bring Wayne Gilman in here really quick. You're one of your colleagues, Mr. Wayne Gilman, our other co-host. As you can hear, we have the legendary Bob Law on. So I want to say hello to him quick, and we can let him continue.
Oh, certainly. Good evening, Bob. It's been a while.
Hey,
I recognize those dulcet tones.
Good to hear from you. But let me just come quick to the point,
yeah,
though. I just think that it is time to start to examine the people who support Trump, what that is about. There's a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners, and it created a lot of controversy when the scholars, a Jewish scholar who wrote it, published it, and his central theme was Hitler came to power because of ordinary German people. He indicts all the German people. And other people said that was going too far. But he said the danger is that these guys like Hitler, like Trump, that they are supported by the ordinary citizens. The book points out that the 500 policemen who were in that black shirts detail that did the real mean, dirty work back in civilian quarters, that those people were not specially trained, specially groomed, not raised up in some anti-Semitic academy. These were just ordinary Germans who answered an ad saying that we want to create this kind of police force. So he makes the point that there's a danger in overlooking the behavior and attitudes of the ordinary people. And ordinary Americans, particularly white folk, and there's some black folk who support Trump. You just saw some black preachers who Trump called out, and they were actually willing to go meet with Trump. And then one of them was actually willing to say this could be the best president that black America ever had. You know, so that is my concern. I think we should begin to focus some attention on the political climate that is being nurtured and kept alive by the Trump Americans, not just Trump so much anymore, but what's wrong with these people who are pretending that Trump is credible?
Yeah, it's insane. Bob, Kay here. Listen, I've been saying ever since I saw Trump declare that he was going to run for the presidency, I said to my children, my kids, Eric, Lisa, Gina, Chrissy, that he reminds me of Hitler. When he stood there and said he was going to be running for the presidency of the United States, he reminded me of Adolf Hitler. Because I saw some early footage a long time ago when it first started in broadcasting, some old television newsreel that I got from somewhere, you know, one of the colleges, one of my doing research. I sent Hitler, and he still reminds me of Hitler.
Well, I think that's where these discussions need to go. As I listen to the discussions on television, and unfortunately, most people rely on television as their single source of information. So if you're watching MSNBC and CNN and those cable news shows, those cable talk shows, and that becomes, for many, many people, their single source of information. They don't read. They don't go to forums and listen.
Yeah.
They just look at TV. And if you're looking at TV, you will notice that they don't even, it's not necessarily their fault. They don't even have enough time to even play a clip with that is the entire statement. And I saw once that they were interviewing somebody and they said, listen, I want you to listen to what so-and-so said. And they played a clip. And then they said, what about that? And the guy they were talking to said, wait a minute, you didn't play enough of the clip. He said more than that. And the guy was aware of that statement. So he repeated what else had been said. But had he not said that, people watching would never even have given that thought that there was more to it than what they had been shown on TV. And it's just, you know, the single TV as a single source of information is really inadequate. It's really insufficient.
Yeah.
However,
exactly. I'm so glad. I don't mean to cut you off there, Bob, but I just want to chime in. I mean, we come from an era in which WWRL was not just an apparatus in which to hear music. There was significant talk shows on that station as well as the old WLIB. And I'm not thinking, you know, it's not to say I can't move with the times, that everything has changed and social media is here. But you're right, television shouldn't be the only immediate source for black folk, white folk, anyone, to get definitive information as to what's going on. And then it depends on who you work for, who's running these operations. I mean, Trump has an entire network on his behalf. And there may be one or two people in there who are balanced in their thinking, but the lion's share of their commentators and talk show hosts are basically trying to empower and cement what this man has already started. You know?
Absolutely.
And then
there's a key. When you say that this media actually empowers, right now people are talking about this woman, Omarosa.
Yeah.
And they all, as you look at TV, all of them are saying that she's a master of the media and that she was trained by Trump and that she knows how to manipulate and move the media. Well, that's what they used to say about Al, that he was a master of using the media. It was not Al's idea that the media would cover everything he did. And even when other people were around, I remember being at a rally, and the same thing happened with Omarosa. It's not that she's so masterful at handling the media. The media has decided to prop her up. She's their weapon against Trump. And they hide it by saying that she knows how to manipulate us so well. If you know you're being manipulated, then why do you go for it? They are propping her up. You know, I remember being at a rally with Al out in Brooklyn some years ago, and there were about six or seven people on the to speak, and everybody was there, and so I spoke, because I had to leave to go do night talk, and I spoke and I said, I just want y'all to be aware. See, all of these reporters are here. The whole back of the church is lined with reporters and cameras, and as each of us gets up to speak, you will notice that they never turn on their cameras. They never turn on the light. They never turn on the microphone because they are waiting for Al. They came to wait for Al. When Al comes up to speak, they are going to turn on their microphones. They're going to turn on their cameras, and they were sent here to get Al. Didn't set that up himself. He didn't tell them come. He didn't send out a press release saying come see me. That was their own deliberate decision. And when I was leaving, one reporter came over to me and he said, you know, I never even thought about it, but you were right. My editor told me, go get footage on Sharpton. Did not interested in the best of y'all. That's the media makes those kinds of decisions themselves as to, and then they pretend that they are being manipulated by somebody who is so masterful at how to control the media. It is, it's nonsense. That is the word. Don't use that word. It is utter nonsense. But that is why, see, an independent media is so important, and I believe that is why black media, first talk, news talk, was the target. And once news talk is marginalized and put out of business, then music radio is the next target. And so music radio has, for the most part, been put out of business. And like in New York and in cities around the country, there's not any black music radio station in many cities. In New York City, there's one black music radio station. BLS is still playing music. The rest of those stations, Hot 97 and Power 105, what they play is not music. The people they put on the air are not artists. They are traitors to their race, and they are promoting ideas that are anti-black, anti-woman, anti-life. They romanticize violence, and they glorify dehumanizing language. And you'll notice that Facebook and Google have just removed people for using dehumanizing language and for romanticizing violence. But the stations that still do that because they target black audiences primarily, they are allowed to continue to do that. Their advertisers continue to spend money to keep them on the air. So apparently, we have not yet convinced them that black lives really do matter.
Amen on that, you know. And it's a pity that some of the stations you mentioned are owned by the same company.
Oh, yeah. But in order for them to dominate the marketplace of ideas, see, they had to remove us. Because see, our ideas are as powerful as any ideas in the world. Our ideas can compete with any ideas in the world. So if they are not willing to to leave us in the marketplace of ideas, they can bring Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh. I don't know if Rush Limbaugh is still alive. They can bring all of those people, put them on the air, but then put us on the air. When we were back in the day that Wayne was referring to, there's a whole lot of things that are happening now that could not have happened. That there would have been a balance, there would have been an explanation, there would have been some pushback because of the kind of thing we did. Consider this, and this is what really got the attention of white supremacy. The Million Man March was called for by Minister Farrakhan. So that offended and alienated everybody. All of the major black and white prominent political personalities said, don't go. Everybody said, don't go to the march. Only prominent black political personality who would not say don't go was Al Sharpton. He didn't say go. but he would not attack the march along with everybody else. David Dinkins attacked it. Charles Rangel, Rudolph Giuliani, everybody said don't go. Well, did they go? And it was Black Talk Radio that promoted and explained the march. And Black Talk Radio, Black News Radio, Black News Reports that talked about the march and talked about why we thought it was important that people go. And so what it did was, Jimmy Breslin wrote about this in his column. I think his column was in the Daily News, where he asked essentially, how did this happen right up under our nose? We didn't promote this. We didn't make this happen. How did it happen? And it happened because of the strength and influence, not only of Black Radio just as a media platform, but because the people on Black Radio were among some of the most trusted Black people in the country. There are people who listen to us every day. I remember the day that the audience fell in love with Kay Thompson.
Tell me, preach.
Yeah, I remember Kay Thompson said something. Kay Thompson said something about an African liberation movement or organization. I don't remember exactly, but she said it wrong. She said the name wrong, and she like just said it. She, because she's a poor little thing. She don't know. So she and when she did that, when she did that, there's a brother, well-known Pan-Africanist, well-renowned, well-respected leader in the Pan-Africanist movement and the Black nationalist movement in New York City. He called right
Dr.
in.
Dr. Ben?
No, no. You see, I said brother. I didn't say a name. Why you want to type by? Anyway.
Uh-oh.
I'm having trouble raising this child, you know. But anyway, he called in, and he chastised her on the air. He scolded her, and he said, you said that wrong. Whatever it was, you said that wrong, and you have to know these kind of things. If you're going to be on the air, if you're going to be on the air, you got to know what you're talking about. And Kay Thompson said, well, in this little soft, sweet voice, she said, well, thank you so much for calling me and correcting me. And thank you for helping me get it right, because I'm new to this and I don't really know all of this yet. I'm just learning. So if I make a mistake, please call me and tell me, help me learn. I was listening to it in my car. I could hear the audience say, "Oh, Paul," and then they started calling in, saying they started calling in. They were saying, "Kay, you're doing all right, sister. Don't even worry. You're okay. You're doing fine. You're going to be okay." They fell in love with her right then, because she responded. Her response was so perfect. The hardcore, hardline nationalists started to say, all right. He almost said, I'm sorry, I called. And so Black people, the black audiences had a great deal of faith and confidence in Black broadcasters. They always had.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And even the music personalities, they had a great deal of confidence in the music personalities as well. And so it was necessary in order to dominate the marketplace of ideas, not to compete with us, but to remove us. And that is where we are at this point in terms of mainstream media. For the most part, we have been removed from that marketplace.
Well, I tell you, Bob, I mean, based on what you're saying, it sounds like it actually could happen again if we had proper ownership.
Yes.
Mm.
Yep. Well, you know, the problem with let me put it like this. We lost what we had because we most definitely did not have proper ownership. You know, I was part of the movement that made the demand for Black ownership. You know, put heavy heat pressure on Novak, who owned BLS, who owned it, wasn't in the city that he owned LIBAMFM.
Right.
It wasn't even BLS, but it was AM/FM. Heavy pressure on everybody for Black ownership, including Egmont Sonderling, who owned RL. He wasn't going to give up his station, but he began to put Black people in key positions. Black general, Black program directors, Black public affairs directors started a campaign looking for Black people in the news, and that came from political pressure. because all we did was say there has to be a black presence. We didn't say who it should be. We didn't say we didn't have any criteria for that. The brothers in the street, the Harlem Black Panther Party, the people who were putting their pressure on, we didn't say who. We just said black. And one of the reasons we just said black was because there was such a black consciousness movement growing that we were just confident that all black folk would be fine. Well, it turned out that wasn't the case at all. And we lost what we had because we really did not have credible, quality, conscious black leadership, black ownership at that time. And they were easily manipulated and easily marginalized, you know. But now, however, it could work, although they're no longer selling radio stations, you know. Viacom and Clear Channel, which is now what iHeart, they own hundreds of radio stations each, you know. Clinton's telecommunications bill, see, Clinton, who everybody thought he was our friend, Clinton's telecommunications bill said that essentially what it said is that now you can own as many stations as you want in any given market.
Wow.
Right? And so that's heralded as a good idea, as opening the doors. You can have there's no restrictions anymore. However, who can afford to own as many stations as they want? Percy Sutton couldn't. You know, he couldn't afford to own as many as he wants, but Disney could. iHeart could, Viacom could, and so that legislation was really constructed for them to put them in a position to easily marginalize independent black-owned radio, along with their collusion with Arbitron, the ratings company, to give out false information. When Andrew Cuomo was attorney general, he brought the lawsuit against Arbitron. And the sister who was the attorney general out in California, she also brought the same lawsuit, and they charged Arbitron with deliberately giving out false and misleading information that was detrimental to the survival of black radio. And they had we have been saying that they were doing that for years. They got away with it for years. By the time Cuomo brought the lawsuit, they settled out of court, but that is in the settlement out of court is where we are victimized again by inadequate black ownership, because they agreed to a settlement, they took some money, and went on back to business as usual, and eventually they were out of business. They didn't do anything to change the condition. They just took some money to be quiet, and you know, I had a conversation with someone in Cuomo's office when I was doing my film on black radio, and tried to get somebody from their office to come in and talk about that lawsuit, talk about that initiative against Arbitron. They wouldn't send anybody, but the person we were talking to said that they did comment among themselves about how it was strange that black owners did not jump up and take advantage of that lawsuit and use that as a sledgehammer to against Arbitron, you know, and so comes back to what I believe Wayne was saying. It is about the quality of ownership.
And one thing, Bob, you know,
but what is the status of black radio right now? Is it dead? Can it be revived? What has to happen?
Well,
was it a thing of the past period?
I would say that I wouldn't say it was dead, but it has been knocked out. It might be unconscious, but it's not dead. But what has to happen is it's no longer a question of the ownership and the format and all of that. It's no longer that. It's no longer that. The power that can determine the possibility lies with the listener. See, black consumers have to say, we want a radio station. If we were to come up with the money to even do a radio station, Dr. Lomax in Philadelphia owns WURD, small AM. Now he's got an FM component with it. His daughter Sarah is running the radio station. She's doing a remarkable good job. But what it takes, though, is for the audience to say to McDonald's and to Wendy's and Pepsi and pick them two, maybe two at a time, if we don't hear commercials on our station, we'll stop buying your product. If they were to say that to Nike, as well as McDonald's, they acknowledge that the black consumer is the driving force behind their success. Not mm-hmm. that black kids buy sneakers. They don't buy all the sneakers that Nike sells. However, Nike acknowledges it. If you don't believe it, Google it. Google Nike and black youth. Nike and the black consumer. Nike acknowledges it, that black youth not only buy shoes, they influence globally shoe sales. Black youth buy, but they don't buy all the Nike, but because of them, Latino kids buy them, white kids buy them, Asian kids buy them. Black people have always been the trendsetter.
Yeah, that's been going on for years, the Nikes. We've been running it since, you know, Spike took over and did the whole wave of Be Like Mike and started doing the Mars Blackman thing. Even before that, I mean, with Converse sneakers, when Dr. J got his first sneaker deal, if you remember back in the day. I know I'm speaking of your guys' time now when I start talking about Dr. J and all them back in the day. But you remember that, right, Mr. Law? I know that that was when it started. We really started influence. From began from Dr. J on down, and then Nike just took it to the stratosphere, as you just quoted, you know, and so much fact, like so much to the point where they have to admit it, that we're influencing the style of sneakers now.
That's right. And the point is, blacks as consumers have enormous power, not just as purchasers of the product, but as the people who influence sales among all other people. So if black women, if you were to go to Philadelphia and if black women were to say to Revlon, we don't hear any commercials on WURD. We spend a lot of money with you. If you don't put some commercials on this black-owned radio station, we will stop buying your product. See, that's what it's going to take. See, the advertising people in black media, and they still do this. You just look at the report just published, and they publish it every year, about the spending power of black folk and how much money we spend. And if you read it, they say things like black people are great consumers. They spend more money than their white counterpart on hair products. And so hair manufacturers, there's a great market there for you. You should be advertising into that market. Well, the hair manufacturer says, well, if you just told me that black women are outspending their white counterparts on hair care products and I don't even advertise, why would I start advertising? I'm already getting your money.
Right.
You know, and the black salespeople have never said that. They've always said, you're getting our money. You should spend more money courting us, spend more money in black media because we are willing to spend. The manufacturer said, what do you mean willing to spend? Y'all are already spending. I don't have to spend any money to get your money. What we should be saying to the industry is, if you don't spend money in black media, we will stop buying your products. See, that's what the minister meant when he said justice or else. Justice or else, we will stop buying your product. And we have never, in an effort to be safe and non-threatening, we have never been willing in the media industry, the owners, particularly the owners, have never been willing to say or else, you know, and they never got any money. I was in a meeting with the black owners in New York City, people around the table, with the black owners of the radio, black radio stations in New York City. We were all at this table, sitting next to Reverend Sharpton. They had called Al to ask him if he would be the spokesperson to go to Madison Avenue and to say that you're not spending money fairly with black media. They had just discovered the Katz memo, where the memo from Katz Media Buying Organization had said, don't buy black media. They're not prospects. They're more like suspects, is what the memo said. And so since
yeah,
then,
I remember
wow.
that. Yeah, right? And, that's and been, I also wow. remember something to the effect that I don't want to call a sponsor, you know, because it's going back into time, but I believe a very prominent soap company felt that blacks did not use soap to wash.
Yeah,
that
well.
Was an excuse not to get advertising on LIB.
And see, what happens, though, is that they decided that since that Katz memo had been revealed, we have to go to Madison Avenue and we have to demand respect. We have to demand that you spend money in black media. And I was at the meeting. I was at the table. He's not here, sir. At the table, the black owners said, well, we really can't go as black people. We're going to have to find other people to come with us. We're going to have to get some Latinos. We're going to have to get some women-owned stations. We can't just go in there as black people and demand that as black people we be treated fairly, even though it is as black people we are being discriminated against. But we can't say that. Otherwise, we'll never get in the door. So let's go out and recruit other people to come in with us. See, and so they watered down their hand from the very beginning. Too cowardly to stand up and say, I'm black. One of the things that they did out of that whole thing is Al did a conference at the Millennial, I think it's called the Millennial Hotel in Midtown, and brought people together, ad agency people came, manufacturers product folk came, and a Cuban woman came up from Miami, and she was one of the speakers. And when she came up to say, and when she spoke, she said, I know that this industry, this advertising industry, has set aside a certain amount of money for what they call minority buys. And so I know you've set up a certain amount of money you're going to divide up between Latinos, black, I don't know who, Asian. And she said, I've come to tell you I want all of the money. I don't want to split it with anybody. I want all of the money. And if you are going to continue to receive money from the Latino consumer, you have to give me all of the money that you set aside for minority buy. And she said, and black radio, black media, I'm not trying to take anything away from you. When it's your turn to speak, you should say exactly the same thing. And let's force these manufacturers, these agencies, to deal with us on our terms. And then Pepe Sutton was the person who spoke on behalf of black media and didn't say a mumbling word.
No, Bob.
The inadequacies of ownership.
No
one
comment.
Of the things that's really disturbing. crickets on that.
Y'all want me to be the one get in trouble, Wicked.
I'm part of depositions, Bob.
Yeah, okay. I'm just teasing you.
I hear you.
Just let it be known, Kate Thompson made me tell these stories.
You wanted to say Byron. Let Byron jump in here.
Yeah, this is Byron. This is Byron down in Washington, D.C. And Bob, you mentioned something that's very interesting, because I just came back from Atlanta, Georgia, and down in Montgomery, where I went to the Equal Justice Initiative Museum. And I talked to people, and I asked them, even in Atlanta, family to gathering. And I said, okay, my family's got a lot of intellectuals in them. And I talked about Stacey Abrams and saying, you know, you have the chance right now to turn this red state blue. You have to get out and vote. And yet there's this notion that of such a depressed people that they don't think they can overcome. And by what you just said about the black radio station, we are guilty of helping to gentrify and colonialize our own communities. Because we keep thinking we need to have this relationship with the other group of race to validate our own existence. And yet we forget about Auburn Avenue being the richest black street in Georgia, and we forget about the success of Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we did not have to have a single influence or financial backing by any white bank, any organization, because we kept that money within our own community. We need to get that back into our bloodstream, because when we stop believing that we have the capacity, even the numbers, we outnumber the folks, and we're still thinking like minorities. We got to start thinking like a majority, and acting and working on behalf of our communities. And you hit the nail on the head with your assessment, because I heard you say it. And in some aspects, we are in that process right now where our communities are being taken over by colonizers, because we think we need them.
You mentioned Stacey Adams. Is her name Abrams?
Stacey Abrams.
One of the things that she said in announcing her candidacy for governor, she said that she feels she went to the scripture and the book of Esther, and she likened what she is doing unto Esther, where she said we are, and she was talking about herself and everybody with her. She said, as Esther was told, that perhaps you were brought here for a time such as this. And that's a key point to understand. We have always had a leadership that would emerge that was perfect for the time. For a time such as this, the question for us now has to be, are we getting the leadership we need for a time such as this? Black leadership seems to be very much confused by the changing demographic. In New York City, where gentrification is taking place, we've got black elected officials who are in Fort Greene and Bed-Stuy who no longer have a black voting majority. They have never done anything to increase voter registration and to register more black folk in that district. They've never done it. They've never even attempted to do that. They're watching whites move in. They're watching whites move in through a racially discriminatory housing policy where the only people moving into these new condos and high-rises that are going up are white people. It's part of a whole racially discriminatory housing policy. But the black leadership seems confused, so that the borough president of Brooklyn, for instance, Eric Adams, he says that when he looks at a problem, he doesn't look at race. He just looks at the issue. He doesn't see race. And now he says that because of the changing demographic in Brooklyn. So he doesn't feel that it is safe for him to say, I'm aware of black people, and I'm aware of the particular needs that black people have. See, black people have an exceptional experience in this society. Black people are at the bottom of a number of things, not because of errors in judgment or lazy or irrational. It is the result of policy, deliberate policy, that has created a dysfunctional school system, that has created income inequality. You know, it is deliberate policy on every level, even in terms of inadequate health care. So black people, as a result of there has been a great deal of damage done to black people as a result of racist policy. It makes sense, therefore, that we would take steps to repair the damage done to black people, because the experience of black people is not the same as the experience of other people in Brooklyn and in New York City. So black people really do need attention paid to our exceptional experiences in this social construct. So for a black politician to say, I don't see race, I just see issues, that makes him the only politician in the city that doesn't see race. Everybody else is moving to protect their own interests. One of the ways that they took Adam Powell's district away from black folk was to redraw the lines. they redrew the lines to include a heavy Dominican community and a heavier Dominican population, because if you put a significant number of Dominicans in that district, they are going to vote for the Dominican candidate. The black candidate never had a chance, because everybody else sees race and thinks in terms of empowering their group. The young woman who just won the congressional seat, Cortez, in the Bronx and Queens, she said that when she wakes up every morning, she says to herself, just remember, you're a Puerto Rican girl from the Bronx. She's not it is possible for you to be true to your identity, to recognize the specific needs of your people, and at the same time have a strategy that will allow you to address the needs of everyone without marginalizing your own group. And see, what I'm saying is that if you're an elected official and you can't figure out how to deal effectively for black people, if you're a black elected official or a black person running for office, and you can't figure out how to serve the very necessary and essential needs of black people and also serve the needs of the other people in your district, then you shouldn't run for office. You're not competent to do the job.
Well, somebody should have left David Dinkins' playbook around, because I think that's what led to his political demise, you know, with all due respect.
Yep.
He tried to serve everybody without identifying with what he was dealing with his base.
Well, and the thing is that everybody can play the race card for black people. See, and Atlanta, Georgia is a primary example. Mary Norwood came within 700 votes of disrupting the Maynard Jackson machine. 700 votes. That's you think about it, and they got a black city council president, a female, Keisha Lance Bottoms, black mayor, and the power base came within 700 votes of being totally disrupted. And we can't have that happen. And Atlanta is right now the black mecca of this country.
I can tell you from experience that there's a problem, and we got just 3 minutes. I can tell you from experience that sometimes when you get a lot of black elected officials, and I know I'm not telling you gentlemen anything you don't know, but some of them get a little carried away with their position, and they kind of forget really what the mission is that you stated, Mr. Law. And you know how we do. I've seen it here in Newark, you know, the example that the great Maynard Jackson set could have been followed in Newark with Ken Gibson, and certainly with some of the other mayors that followed. But a lot of the contracts and things like that were not chosen to build up black wealth and that black power base to support a political movement of that nature. And so we are struggling with that now, because as you are all aware, Newark is going through that whole gentrification thing now, becoming a hub that a lot of people want to move to. And as I drive through that community, or when I visited the borough of Brooklyn where I used to live, when all of us that work for Spike were kind of living in that Fort Greene area, now it's a different place, as you talked about, Mr. Law. It's a completely different place. And that's one of the things I loved about Brooklyn back in the day, that there were so many beautiful, progressive black people like the way I was raised, you know, kind of like a lot of the black people I would meet at the historically black colleges and universities. Not so much from an economic or even a social standpoint, but just from a perspective, woke standpoint, you know? So I see that going. But we got 2 minutes. I talked at the last minute or two, so we need to really wrap it up.
Yeah.
Ma, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I do. Listen, thank you, guys. Thank you very much for Bob Law, especially, Wayne, Byron. Next week we're going to be talking to Wayne Gilman. Wayne is going to be dealing with the historic black colleges. Yeah.
Now.
Matt, I'm sorry,
that's
Wayne.
Nice to hear.
I mean, what? Mal.
I'm not a graduate of Mal one, Wolfa. But, you know, that's, I can tell you about them, you know.
I get you, Wayne, and Mal mixed up, but Mal, he's going to be here to talk about the historic black colleges, and so that's going to be really interesting. Bob Law.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Robert. Talk to you again.
All right, now, thank you. Thank you for having me. Okay. All right.
Good to hear your voice, right, Bob.
All right. Wayne Gilman, how you doing, sir? Want to say thank you.
All right.
As always.
Thank you as well. Yeah.
All right. And Byron Saunders, Brother Byron Saunders, thank you as well, sir, for a stimulating conversation. We should do it again next week.
Peace and love always.
All right, brothers. Talk to you guys next week. This is the K Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can listen to us live every week, 8 to 9 p.m. on Wednesday evening, or we're also archived as well. My name is Citizen Payne. I am the Sun, and you are?
K Thompson from K Thompson Live, everyone. Join us every Wednesday from 8 and from. Let's love to drop the phone. Anyway, good night. Join us next week for an exciting show also.